It is 8:30, and we have with us live in the studios once again, Joff Parrish, co-editor at Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
No Maria this morning.
No, Maria overslept. And that's a shame because I have a something of a cold, which people can probably hear. It's mostly in my throat and my head, and so I was hoping that she would do most of the talking this week.
You won't get any of that.
But it is me, sad. So I will...
Apparently that extra job she's got working as an elf at Macy's has caused her to...
Well, in any event, I will soldier through, and it really is me. You just can't tell it because my voice is so... Yeah. It sounds so bad, so...
All right. Well, still plenty to cover, so let's start with the further... coverage of the U.S. Spying scandal via the NSA that had some more revelations this week.
Yeah, lots of response to last a week ago Friday's New York Times story. The most interesting part was a Boston Globe story that broke on Friday, which to its credit, the PI reprinted locally, suggesting that the way the NSA's program worked was not to target specific suspects that might have ties to terrorists, but to actually set up search terms and probably monitor all overseas calls from all Americans, and then flag those for which the search terms came up positive, and those would be actually listened to by a human being. Now, there's a number of problems with that. You can certainly understand, if that's the case, why President Bush wouldn't have tried to get a FISA warrant for that, because he couldn't get a FISA warrant for tens of millions of people. I mean, you know, I've made calls to Japan, I've made calls to Palestine and Iraq, and I've probably been eavesdropped on. Maybe I should sue. Maybe make it a class action suit.
Only that, look at all the emails that automatically go out.
No, absolutely. And faxes also being monitored. The New York Times on Friday... advanced to that story and basically got confirmation from people within the program, within NSA, that that was in fact how it worked. They also buried in the story, actually it wasn't that a very good story yesterday, it didn't talk at all about the possibility, illegality of the program or the political fallout from it, but it did sort of passingly mention that the program probably also monitored some international to international calls, because over the past few years, the United States government has quietly been encouraging telecommunications companies to route some of those international calls through American switches. And that's how the NSA did its culling of calls, was by monitoring the switching systems. And also that some, quote, domestic communications were monitored, suggesting that the program was even broader, and then it monitored in-country to in-country telephone calls. That really hasn't gotten that much of attention, but it was in the New York Times story. There were a few other interesting revelations this week. One of them was the AP came up with an interesting list of times over the past 4 years where Bush has claimed publicly that wiretaps require a warrant. In fact, I'll just read a couple of them. On April 19th, 2004, Bush said the Patriot Act enabled law enforcement officers to use, quote, roving wiretaps, which are not fixed to a particular telephone, against terrorism. As that has been used against organized crime, quote, you see, what that means is you've got a wiretap by court order, and by the way, everything you hear about requires court orders, requires that there be permission from a FISA court, for example. That was in Hershey, Pennsylvania. And then we have also on April 20th, 2004, on the same next day, actually, in Buffalo, New York, anytime you hear, this is Bush again, anytime you hear the United States government talking about wiretap, it requires, a wiretap requires a court order. Well, this is just a bald-faced absolute lie, because at that point, Bush had been running this secret program for 2 years. He'd not only authorized it, but reauthorized it a number of times. We know that he's renewed the program 30 times and has pledged to do so additionally in the future. And here he is reassuring the American people that not only does no such program exist, but that the law requires that you go through these kind of hoops, which, of course, is not what he's saying at all right now. Another interesting revelation that came out this week involves Samuel Alito, the right-wing radical whose confirmation hearings for the U.S. Supreme Court will begin on January 9th. And I think there needs to be a lot more grassroots organizing against this guy. You know, we need to be besieging our senators and everybody else's senators with emails and faxes and phone calls to not confirm this guy, and, you know, get your friends and neighbors and strangers on the street to do the same thing. Alito, in 1984, when he was working for Reagan's Justice Department, argued in a memo that exactly these sorts of programs, warrantless wiretaps instigated by the Attorney General or the President for national security reasons, were completely legal. And this comes in the context of Alito's record of wanting to vastly expand presidential and executive branch powers. So if these types of programs ever came before the Supreme Court, and the chances are very good that they will, we know which way Alito is going to side on this, as is probably true for John Roberts and Clarence Thomas and Antonin Scalia and you know, at least one of the other Republican appointees. So, you know, this is what happens after a number of decades of stacking the courts with conservative appointees, is that these types of violations of the Constitution are ruled constitutional.
Getting back to the specifics on the NSA coverage, one of the things I'm having trouble with is it was my understanding that the NSA has for, you know, at least the last 10, 20 years, their standard operating procedure was to monitor all international traffic.
Yeah. So example.
Right. Yeah. So that particular thing isn't really new. You know what I mean? It's like, I think there's certain aspects of this with the going through FISA and getting these different,
They were monitoring international traffic in other parts of the globe, but their charter and also the FISA law itself, the law that was passed by Congress in 1978, specifically forbids the NSA from doing that kind of monitoring on U.S. soil or of U.S. citizens on U.S. soil. That's the problem. The president has specifically overridden that law because of his claims as his prerogative as commander-in-chief during wartime.
Okay. But even then, it seems like it's pretty hazy. I mean, when you're saying on U.S. soil, it's like, well, technically once, you know, the signal, like, hits the airwaves, you know, and or, you know, the cable, like, leaving the U.S., then essentially they can pick it up. I mean, legally that would seem to be the case, but it seems like there's still some gray area there, but...
Yeah, there probably is gray area, but it seems very clear what the intent is. The intent is to spy on U.S. citizens. I mean, you can make the argument that, you know, signals leave U.S. soil because they go up, bounce up to a satellite and then come back down. So you can monitor it while it's at the satellite. I mean, you know, where the signal physically is matters a lot less than where it originated from.
All right. Let's move along. Another interesting story this week was the FBI doing some monitoring of radiation.
Yeah, this broke in the U.S. News and World Report's website on Thursday and was subsequently confirmed on Friday by the FBI. And there's a pretty good story on it in the PI this morning. The FBI, since 2002, again post 9/11, has been using radiation monitors to search for dirty bombs and other implements of terror outside mosques and various other sites associated with Muslims in Washington D.C. and five other American cities, and the five other cities are New York, Chicago, Detroit, Las Vegas, and Seattle. So we have had that going on here locally, again, without a warrant, probably illegally. The closest relevant Supreme Court case also partially originated from Washington State, and it involved the use in the war on drugs of heat-seeking equipment to try and suss out drug-making equipment inside private homes. The heat-seeking equipment was outside the home, and it was done without a warrant. And the Supreme Court ruled that was an invasion of a home without a warrant, and it was a violation of the Fourth Amendment and unreasonable search and seizure. Well, it's extremely analogous between heat-seeking equipment and radiation monitoring equipment. It's the same idea, where it was done outside the residence or outside the mosque or outside the building, was used to monitor what might be inside the building. And again, this is done without a warrant, was done without court supervision, as with the NSA thing, where the question is who's, you know, it doesn't even matter in terms of the NSA, whether it's automated or a human is doing it, because the human has to devise the search terms for the computers. In this case, humans have to decide what targets to go after. And of course, they were all targets where brown people congregate. It's a classic case of racial profiling. As you can imagine, a lot of Muslims in the Seattle area are pretty upset by this. Has not gotten a lot of media attention. The PI has been the only the Times hasn't picked it up yet, and so far as I'm aware, the TV stations haven't either. But this should be a big local story. It's a serious violation of the civil rights of Muslims in this area. And the next question, of course, is who was targeted by these investigations, and what was the FBI's rationale?
It's also interesting that, you know, here they're monitoring radiation illegally, inappropriately, whereas, you know, we're different people who've, like, worked on the issue of dirty bombs a la, let's say, Department of Energy trucks transporting waste, a la depleted uranium being used off the coast of Washington State, you know, fired in our fishing
right.
grounds. Trucks on the highway that carry this material that we're just, you know, trying to get like placards on to show drivers that the particular, you know, 16-wheeler that you're next to is full of radioactive material. Can't get any support on that from the government.
No, not at all. And the other interesting thing about this is that there have been a number of cases over the last 4 years of harassment of almost entirely Muslim families in the Muslim community for immigration violations, visa violations, deportation proceedings. Groups like Hate Free Zone have just been beating their head against the wall trying to get local media to pay attention to some of these stories, largely without success. So hopefully media will pick this up. We'll see if they do or not. But this is something people should be really quite concerned about.
All right, moving along, the Patriot Act looked like it got an extension.
Yeah, it was originally going to be for 6 months, and then a last-minute compromise between the White House and Republican and Democratic leaders cut it down to 1 month, actually 5 weeks. So it's now set to expire on February 3rd, with all of these revelations that are coming out seemingly on pretty much a daily basis of law enforcement and FBI and NSA and White House abusing of civil liberties on with 9/11 being the war on terror being the rationale for it. It should be pretty clear at this point that the Patriot Act has probably been abused over the last 4 years by law enforcement agencies, and it needs to be curtailed. There need to be limits placed on some of these powers for law enforcement. So this again is something where people who are concerned about civil liberties have about 5 weeks to operate on this. The Patriot Act extension was not the only thing that Congress did just before it adjourned for the holidays. It passed a huge defense spending or budget bill that a lot of other things were attached to. A number of billion of dollars for Katrina relief were there. The torture ban amendment was included. The Graham Amendment, which stripped habeas corpus rights for Guantanamo Bay and other enemy combatant prisoners. A last-minute rider giving immunity for flu vaccine makers, or vaccine makers generally, I think, actually, was in there. The one thing that wasn't in there that our compassionate conservatives who are running the House of Representatives and the Senate stripped out of the bill at the last minute without debate was $2 billion for home heating assistance for people who are too poor to afford the skyrocketing cost of home heating oil, particularly in the Northeast and Midwest this winter. Our compassionate conservatives decided that was not going to be part of the budget bill, so people will not be getting that kind of assistance. The other battle that took place, of course, was regarding ANWR, the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, and Maria Cantwell facing a re-election fight next year. Probably will owe her re-election to Senator Ted Stevens. Stevens did her a massive, massive favor by trying to slip in ANWR oil drilling by the back door. And she was probably the most significant legislative win for the Democrats in the Senate in the Bush era. She actually did a really good job of pulling together a coalition to prevent ANWR drilling from taking place, and she deserves a lot of credit for it. Cantwell certainly has had her problems, you know, her stance on the war, some of her other LDC-ish centrist stances over the years. But on the environment, and on this in particular, she did an outstanding job. Patty Murray also voted against Anwar drilling, but this really pointed up the difference between Cantwell and Murray. Cantwell's in her first term, and she took a leadership position on an issue of concern to not only people in Washington State, but all across the country. Murray's been in the Senate for 13 years and basically raises money and then does favors for the companies that she raises money from, and that's how she uses her Senate seat. She really has not done any, taken the lead on any kind of major legislative issues her entire time in the Senate. You know, Cantwell gets things done and Murray raises money. So it really kind of brings home the difference between the two, even though Murray is ostensibly more liberal than Cantwell is. She just doesn't get things done, and it's really kind of disappointing. But Cantwell did a fine job on this.
Well, sticking with the tangents of the Patriot Act, Jose Padilla is... What's the status with him currently?
Interesting ruling this week by the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals in Richmond, Virginia. This is a federal court of appeals. It's considered one of the most conservative in the country. Rejected the White House's bid to transfer Padilla from military to civilian courts as a result of the indictment that it laid down against Padilla about a month ago. We've talked about this case on this show, of course. What the White House's rationale for laying down the indictment, which didn't mention anything about a dirty bomb plot whatsoever, or for that matter, the natural gas plot to blow up apartment buildings in Brooklyn. It just said that he was part of a support group in Miami that had ties to al-Qaeda in the late 1990s. Well, the Fourth Circuit took note of the fact that this indictment didn't have anything to do whatsoever with any of its public pronouncements on Padilla over the years, or its rationale for holding him as an enemy combatant without access to lawyers or his family or anything else for quite a long period of time, and concluded that what the White House was trying to do was to avoid having the legality of the enemy combatant designation move to the Supreme Court, which it is now scheduled to do. The Fourth Circuit made a ruling that was... That was legal, and the White House, along with trying to transfer Padilla, had also petitioned the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals to vacate that ruling. It refused to do so, and it's likely to go on to the Supreme Court, hopefully before Alito or ascends to it. It was a victory for Padilla because he's trying to get due process. He's trying not to just be dumped into the criminal courts with a spurious case after all this time of being held probably illegally. He and his lawyers want that that technique, the idea of holding U.S. citizens without due process, to be challenged in court, and it looks like that's going to happen.
All right. And how about a Abramoff update?
Jack Abramoff. Interesting reports this week. This is the disgraced Republican super lobbyist who... there are in excess now of four dozen congressmen and congresswomen, mostly Republicans, who have been confirmed as having taken money from Jack Abramoff or his clients at about the same time that they did legislative favors for Jack Abramoff or his clients. As I mentioned a week or two ago, Patty Murray is the number two ranked Democrat on that list. It's mostly Republicans, but there are some Democrats, and her position on the Senate Appropriations Committee makes her a lucrative person to give money to. And so she's taken a lot of money from Abramoff over the years, in excess of $50,000, in fact. But Abramoff is under indictment in a Miami case involving the fraudulent transfer of funds and forgery for $23 million in an attempt to purchase Sun Cruise Casinos, which is a casino gambling boat venture based in Miami. And there's also a murder attached to this case, by the way, of the former owner of Sun Cruise that has been tied, at least indirectly, to Adam Kadan, who was Abramoff's partner in that purchase. Well, Kadan has already pleaded out and is cooperating with the investigation, as is Michael Scanlon, who is Abramoff's lobbying partner in his defrauding of Native American casino tribes for many, many tens of millions of dollars at the same time that they shook down all these members of Congress. Apparently Abramoff is about to flip. that he's in plea bargain negotiations with the feds. They've agreed that he will plead guilty. They have agreed that he will testify against members of Congress. They're just trying to hammer out how much time he'll spend in jail, probably in the range of only 5 to 7 years. But if he starts naming names of how Congress works, mind you, he's probably aware of a number of arrangements on Capitol Hill that do not directly involve just his firm, but do involve K Street lobbyists of all colors and stripes. This could really blow the lid off of how Washington, D.C. works. It's going to be a very, very interesting 2006 to examine just how corrupt Capitol Hill is. And I think people aren't going to be too surprised to find out that it's a sewer. That it really is extraordinarily corrupt, that if you go in with bags of cash, you can pretty much get whatever you want. If you're an ordinary citizen, you don't have any influence because you don't have the bags of cash. We're going to find out a lot more about this in 2006, and if Abramoff is preparing to testify, that could make the nights restless for a lot of congresspeople.
All right. Let's move on briefly to international. It looks like Bolivia has a new president.
Yes, Evo Morales, who you're already getting the scare stories in U.S. media about how this guy admires Fidel and wants to pattern himself over after Hugo Chavez, and he's a socialist and blah, blah, blah. That really misstates his appeal not only in Bolivia but throughout Latin America. He won a resounding victory at the polls. This after a number of years of grassroots agitation by indigenous activists and coca growers from different rural parts of the country that drove out two previous elected governments that were friendly to Washington and the neoliberal consensus and the war on drugs. Morales is the first indigenous leader in South American history, which is pretty inspiring to indigenous people throughout Latin America. He is very much in favor of making sure that Bolivia's extensive natural gas resources, most of which have not been tapped, work to the benefit of poor people in Bolivia, which is in direct contradiction to the efforts of Washington and of large corporations that want to do business with Bolivia to get the resources on the cheap and take the wealth out of the country. And he's patterning that after what Venezuela has been doing with its oil resources, in fact, in terms of finding markets other than the United States to send them and countries other than the United States with which to do business. He's very much critical of the war on drugs and what it has done to poor coca growers in Bolivia who have no other way to find sustenance, and this is what they've traditionally done for hundreds of years. And he argues, and there's a fair validity to what he argues, that it's not their fault if weird-ass gringos in the north chop this up into white powder and put it up their nose. That's not how the plant has traditionally been used in Bolivia, and it shouldn't be their fault, and they shouldn't have their livelihood eradicated because of it. So we're gonna be hearing a lot more about this in 2006, and he's likely to become one of those demons of Latin America along with Chavez. But this also means, and there's another election that's going to happen very shortly in Chile, where a left-leaning candidate is widely expected to win. It's a near clean sweep, with the exception of Colombia. I think every country in South America now has a leftist or left-of-center leader, and much of it has been in reaction to the Bush administration, the war on drugs, 20 years of neoliberalism that has destroyed the economies of many of these countries. Not noticed much this month, but both Argentina and Brazil paid off their foreign debt after they were in debt to the IMF and the World Bank for many, many years under neoliberalism. So there's definitely people walking away from Washington, D.C. and its influence on Latin America these days.
Well, W did say he was a uniter. It's like in that aspect, it's true. You know, real quick, I was watching C-SPAN last night. They're having a forum on the conservative movement, and Frank Gaffney, the neocon's neocon, was one of the speakers, and he had mentioned, you know, the three countries that are the biggest threat to the direction they want to go, and he had said, communist China, Russia, and Venezuela. So It's interesting that they look
yeah, Venezuela is a pretty, they're only 2 days march from Nicaragua, is what I've heard.
Yeah. How many from Texas? All right, let's jump over for a real brief This Week in Iraq.
Yeah, I didn't prepare anything because I thought Maria was going to be here, but there were some stories of interest in Iraq this week. I'll hit on them very briefly. First of all, a number of civilians, scores, maybe hundreds, are said to have been killed by a Marine air campaign in the west of the country near the Syrian border over the last few days. We're also starting to get results from the December 15th election. It looks very much like both Shiite and Sunni clerics' parties did better than expected. The Shiite clerics will control the country. They're very closely aligned with Iran. They will need to make common cause with the Kurdish nationalists in order to have a majority in the National Assembly. The Sunnis, as well as Ayed Alawi's party, the secular person who is backed by Blair and Bush and the West, are claiming extensive vote fraud. They want the election done over in Baghdad. There was a massive demonstration to this effect a couple of days ago, and we'll see how that plays out. It's very likely that what was supposed to give a boost to the democratic process is instead going to help drive Iraq apart and fuel tensions that have already basically started the civil war there, which we've talked about a number of times already on this program.
All right. Well, jump in back briefly to local radio host Mike Webb appears to be in hot water.
Yeah, he was arrested this week, liberal Cairo radio host, and charged with insurance fraud. He's also under investigation for forgery. The details of the case against him, by the way, are at the very good liberal radio talk blog called Blatherwatch, blatherwatch.blogs.com. And they have the charging papers there and a number of comments on Webb's case. He's in hot water. The case against him looks pretty solid. He's claimed that it's all a massive conspiracy of it involves a car accident and the claim for damages on that accident. And it's a long story. I won't go into it here. But it could be bad news for progressives in Seattle if he loses his radio show over this, because there simply aren't many local radio hosts who have the passion that Webb has in local radio. You have some who are left of center, like Dave Ross and Steve Scherr and whatnot, but they tend to be pretty neutral and pretty passive in terms of their advocacy. We need people with fire in their belly, and you know, Air America doesn't have local hosts, and Webb is the only person who delivers that. So his loss would be quite a loss, I think, for progressive radio in Seattle.
And very briefly, people up on Queen Anne are up in arms over a QFC store?
Yeah, this is a project that QFC wants to do where Metropolitan Market is now on Queen Anne Avenue. Metropolitan Market has lost their lease. QFC wants to move in, knock down a low-income apartment building next door and build a massive new structure with second-floor parking and, you know, the kind of big buildings they do, even though they already have stores on Lower Queen Anne and Inner Bay. 300 people showed up at a Queen Anne Community Council land use meeting on Monday night to protest this, and we're going to be hearing a lot more of this in 2006 as it goes to a land review process and goes to the city permitting process. It was absolutely unanimous among people on Queen Anne. They do not want this project to take place. And they have a history in the past. They've beaten off a Circle K store that they didn't like. They've beaten off a Safeway expansion. They've beaten off a McDonald's that was once proposed for the neighborhood. So they've got their act together, and they don't seem to like chain stores very much. And QFC is the latest one to, or Kroger is the latest one to encounter this.
All right. Talking once again with Job Parrish, co-editor at Eat the State, and tell people about your fund drive and where they can find
you. Yeah, we got a lot of things going on these days. We've got our blog going where a lot of these stories have picked up this week. We have our 2005 Media Follies, which we didn't have a chance to get to this week. Maybe we will next week, but it's the most overhyped and underreported stories of the year. That's up on our website, www.eatthestate.org, for all of that. And we've got our fund drive going on, which so far far, frankly, hasn't done very well. We need to do this a couple times a year in order to keep printing our paper and keep doing what we do. Our goal was $6,000, which mostly goes toward our printer, and the rest goes to postage and miscellaneous layout expenses. And only $1,400 of that has come in so far. So we definitely need more help and more support from our readers and listeners. Toward that end, it's a little late for Christmas gift giving, obviously, but we do have some premiums that are fairly attractive for $50 donations. You can choose from either Paul Loeb's The Impossible Will Take a Little While, or the DVD of George Galloway's appearance at Kane Hall last fall, or a tape from David Barsamian's Alternative Radio. $100 gets you two of those. Anyway, whatever you can give, it doesn't really matter whether it's small or large, but if you appreciate what we do, we would really, really appreciate your support. We need it to keep going. You can do donations through PayPal at eatthestate.org. You can also subscribe that way, or you can do it through the paper, and you can or send your donations or send your subscriptions to P.O. Box 85541, Seattle, Washington 98145. If you missed any of that, it's at our website at eatthestate.org, or call area code 206-719-6947.